Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It's a creative career. If I'm constantly cooking, I'm going to burn out. The type of branded business I'm running, I don't want to just like make food for the sake of making food. I think it would come across to my guests.
How do you feel about having 45,000 people follow you?
Eventually, I want to get to a stage where I just, you know, I'm the Bengali omakase chef. They come in and they just trust me to make them food. I don't want to be the spokesperson of any culture.
When you serve food to someone and they take their first bite of your food and they go, this is phenomenal. How do you feel?
I can't put that into words, I think. I don't want to be on this autopilot of like, here's a menu, I made it for you. Off you go, you've paid me money. That's not what I'm doing. If I was doing that, I'd run a restaurant. There has been times I've been bullied in school. People have found my food smelly or like my outfit's weird or whatever. And I don't think I ever really shied away from it. I have this fear that Bengali food will die out because a lot of people don't cook it. What I'm trying to build is that sense of belonging and community, which is what I wanted when I first moved to London.
Welcome, welcome everyone to another episode of Everyday Empires. I'm here with the wonderful Sahini, who is the founder of Smoke and Lime, a beautiful combination of profit, passion, and purpose. Is that fair to say?
Not as much profit yet, I guess. But yeah, the other bits. I actually do have a question. Where am I supposed to be looking?
Oh, at me.
Oh, at you. Okay, not. I was like, am I looking at any of these things? Yeah, I guess not as much profit yet, but maybe. In the next few years, I don't know. But yeah, thank you for having me today. I was looking forward to this chat.
Likewise. And I think it's profits always come and they're always relative. But how people measure success, I think, is always quite interesting, because when you get under the hood of sort of what numbers really look like, the perception of people about success like changes, right? If you're making £100 million a year, obviously, you know, objectively, that's just like a number. It's like, yeah, of course, like you're super rich and you're super successful, fine. But you often hear the term of like people who are doing really well as being very asset rich but cash poor. So what does that mean? It means that, of course, their business is doing quite well, but all the cash that's coming in, they're spending on keeping things moving. Doesn't mean they're not successful. Maybe profits are kind of there on paper, but they're still, you know, they're moving forward. They don't have like a chunk of change in the bank account. But especially when you're starting up and you're early in your journey, that success measurement will move all the time. And just because you're not profitable doesn't mean you're not successful. I mean, like, if you take all the big guys, Amazon wasn't profitable for decades.
Yeah.
Elon Musk, half of his businesses, I mean, most of his businesses aren't profitable until very recently. And, you know, you're talking about some of the richest guys in the world.
I love that you're comparing me to these guys.
Well, you're an entrepreneur.
Love it.
So it's fair. But a lot of people will look at them and they go, oh, Amazon. And they go, oh, the brands that they've built. And relate that to success. So there must be a success measurement around the recognition behind their brand.
True.
And lots of people know Smoke and Lime. You know, very successful supper clubs. From what I understand, they're always sold out and difficult to get, you know, a ticket. So, you know, I think we can be confident in saying you're very successful.
Yeah, my husband was asking me the other day, maybe like a week ago, he was like, do you think you're successful? And I think my immediate answer was like, no, I don't think so, because I feel like I'm just doing what I enjoy and that's kind of it. But yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I feel like I am very asset rich in what I've built over the last nearly 8 years now. It has been a long time. It's the biggest part of my career, for sure. And I feel very lucky in all the connections that I've made through doing what I do. And I really enjoy it. I never feel like work is work, which is, to me, successful.
We talk a lot about on this show around the concept of who marks the entrepreneur's homework. So like when you've worked for big companies or whatever, you have this annual performance review and you've got some boss telling you across these checklists, you know, how successful you are within the company. Kind of feels like you're back at school. You get a little grade, and based on that grade, you either get promoted or you get a bonus or a raise or you don't. And it kind of feels a bit, you know, a good performance review is very hard to come by. Most of the time it feels like, you know, you're kind of just being told to give some feedback about how great you are.
Yeah, I don't think entrepreneurs do performance reviews. I don't know. I tried to do one for myself this last month because I was really busy. And I wrote out all the things I did on LinkedIn. And I was like, wow, I've actually done so much this month. But I never usually do that. And then one of my friends pointed out that I should do it more often. Like once a month, I should just write about all the things I've done. Just to almost keep a check on myself and like give myself a little. Because you don't, like, I think when you're working for yourself, it's really hard to just like keep a measure of what you're doing month to month. It's just like the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And then you forget about all the stuff you've done.
Which is why I really like these conversations, because it's a chance for you to look back and be like, look at all those last 8 years and be like, wow, like imagine day one and then compare to today.
So true.
So Smoke and Lime's got, I think it was 45,000 followers on Instagram alone, which is phenomenal. You've got a well-recognized brand. Your supper clubs sell out, you know, regularly, from my understanding or from what I can see. That's how my lovely wife met you, which is amazing. You know, when you go to do events, you know, they seem to be very high profile, seem to be well-recognized brands that you're associated with. So when it kind of sometimes feels normal, because you're kind of like, yeah, but you know, last month I did this and then
I agree.
Did that.
Yeah, it feels like, oh yeah, it's just, this is just it.
Yeah, but I think what I'd love to explore today with you is think back 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and the stuff that you were doing, and perhaps you were working through the social media and kind of posting stuff, and you're not getting as much engagement as you did now, and you're posting supper clubs, and you know, I think my understanding is they've always been pretty up there, but not from day one, I imagine.
No, of course not. Yeah.
So, and then the frequency has obviously improved as well. So it's a chance for you to look back and say, you know, this got all these amazing things. But one, to come back to the homework point that I try to bring out with a lot of clients is, well, what are you actually capable of today? You know, versus 3 years ago, 5 years ago. Well, I'm sure day one when you were organizing supper club, it was very much like, oh, what do I put on the menu, and where do I get the ingredients from, and this is how it works. And nowadays, you're like, oh, I've got one tomorrow. It's no problem.
I can do it in my sleep. Yeah. That is interesting. Okay, we can do a little memory lane. I don't know, journey of this. So when I actually did my first supper club, firstly, that was after a long time of contemplating doing an event. And 2018, I had a full-time job. I was working and managing two restaurants in one in Soho, one in Mayfair. And my boss at the time, he was just really supportive. He'd had some of my food. I don't think I really had a food identity apart from just being Bengali. And I think I just wrote a menu that like I'd eaten a lot of the food. It was very traditional. You know, I'm literally talking like goat curry, like a kosher mangsho, pulao, little chaat. And yeah, it was very like what I would think is a luxury Bengali meal is what I put on the menu. And but I know as soon as I did my first ever supper club, when people were leaving that day, and actually Asma Khan was one of the guests at the supper club because I'd worked with her at the time. And yeah, she was on the table. As people were leaving, everyone was like, you should do this again. And I think that night I was like, yeah, I feel like this is what I want to do. And I never considered it before then. I think it was just a hobby. I like cooking for people. I like hosting my friends. And I would say pretty much in that week, I was like, oh, I can see myself doing this for the rest of my life. What that looked like now versus then, like it's not maybe all the stuff I imagined. It's a lot more. But I think at the kind of heart of it, I still host these quite intimate dinners in my flat. And the essence of that is the same, which I really love.
We've talked about scale and sort of how do you like make even more money and do, obviously the answer is you just do loads of supper clubs every single night and it's crazy. But you don't want to do that, right? You want to keep that intimate feel.
I do. Yeah. This is the thing. I think for the first couple of years at least, again, a lot of this is like prior knowledge of like having worked as an operations manager, having worked in a Michelin restaurant before as well, not in the kitchen, but in front of house. I think I saw, for me, this is always very true. I think I've discovered things I don't really want before I've discovered what I want. With supper clubs, I don't want to lose that intimacy and that cozy feeling because I think what makes them really special is that people are coming into my home, wherever that is, or a home-like setting. It's not more, ideally, it's not more than like 15 people because that's when you get the connections. And beyond food, I think what I'm trying to build is that sense of belonging and community, which is what I wanted when I first moved to London. So that's the kind of heart of what I'm trying to do beyond plating food. Obviously, the food has to be tasty.
Yeah.
But it's that, and I don't think that can happen if I scale in certain ways, but maybe different ways. I don't know.
Well, I think there's, because we discussed before around supper clubs kind of being quite a nice part of how you generate revenue, but there's four or five other ways that you can make money. I mean, the classic one for chefs are, of course, cookbooks, which are, many chefs have a plethora of, but you know, something that actually means something to people is difficult to build out. There's obviously other events that you can cater for, that you can bring your cuisine to. And there's obviously the social media side, sponsorship. So there's loads of stuff that sits there. So it's really interesting about, for you, how do you scale? Because it's not just a function of just doing it more frequently. You have, you know, your brand is equally as important. So
yeah, to not lose the essence of the brand.
Yeah, and I love how you've genuinely hugged close to that.
Yeah.
Because you can see it in the way that you post. There's so much passion. You genuinely enjoy cooking food and making people happy, which it brings a smile to my face every time you see, like you feel joyful, and it's not like genuinely. As you go through, you know, people listening now are probably flicking through your social media, and it just brings a smile to your face because it's not just the food; it's also like what it means to you and your culture. So how have you brought like the Bengali culture into your food other than just obviously what it is?
You're probably not even going to believe me when I say this, to be honest. But I've always been really into photography and videography from when I was quite young, actually. So literally since I was a teenager, we got a digital camera. I was obsessed with taking photos and videos. I do have the eye for it, I would say. But that's also a lot of doing. I did GCSE art and the whole thing was photography. My parents very proudly still tell people that I won second prize in the UK.
Congratulations.
I know, as like a 16-year-old. But yeah, I think I've always been into that, obviously away from social media because it didn't exist to that level. And I think with social media, honestly, I actually find it really easy. I don't find social media very hard work because I love videography and photography. So a lot of it for me is just as is. I don't have a schedule. I don't have someone who manages it. I don't have a calendar. Like, I post as and when I feel. And somehow that seems to it seems to be working. I think for me, it is just keeping it very real. I don't really share things that I don't identify with. And I don't share things just for the sake of sharing things at all. It's always very true to what I'm doing, when I'm doing it. And I've had so many of these conversations in the past couple of years where people are like, you should schedule this and do this. It doesn't work for me. For me, what works is, oh, if something really fun happens today, I'll video it and post it. I don't really spend longer than 4 or 5 minutes on anything.
Yeah.
On that, because I also do, it is very transient. Like, you'll agree with me. Like, it's people's attention spans are really little on social media. And I think there's no point getting hung up on like one thing. It's nice to share, but I would be doing that. I think I like to believe that even if social media didn't exist, I'd still be doing it because I had a photography blog back in the day. I had a little website that I'd built myself. Even when I didn't cook, I still did this. So I'd still be doing it, even if social media ceases to exist.
That's amazing. I mean, yeah. But in terms of, you know, someone's listening to this and they go, well, you've built, you know, a great following. Mm. And the principles behind that are clearly like, you know, posting something that you're passionate about, because that kind of energy flows into, you know, how you do the shoot. And obviously you're quite artistic, so the way that you shot it probably makes a huge difference as well. Yeah. But for someone that perhaps doesn't have your photography skills, you're probably telling them, well, go and get some, because if you're going to post on social media.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think it, like, everyone, like nowadays, it's really hard. I think most people do have some sort of vision with what they want to. Sorry, I actually need to sneeze.
Go for it.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Tanya's the editor. She can edit it out. Or keep it in.
I've got no SDs. Okay.
No, fantastic.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Not at all.
Photography skills. What are we talking about? I don't know if like people, it's hard to gain. I think, again, like I'm saying, I'm intrinsically quite artistic. I danced since I was 2 years old. My granddad's an artist. We have that quite intrinsic within ourselves. I like to say a lot of Bengalis are just intrinsically artistic. It's really encouraged in our community to learn an instrument, dance, sing, like, I did more extracurricular activities than studies, you know? So I think, and that, I'm actually not speaking for myself here. I'm speaking on behalf of like most middle class to upper class Bengalis who their parents encourage them to do this stuff. It's really quite common. Like, most of my friends have like at least 3 things they do outside of what their job is or what they studied or whatever. So it is, I don't know. I think if you want to do social media, you should just do it. Like, I just don't think you should think too much about it. It's pretty transient. Post what you want. There's so many accounts and there's so many people that will probably relate to you with whatever you're posting. I think the main thing is consistency. Yeah. It is consistent. I don't look at this very often, but if I do look back at what I've been doing on social media that has been working, I literally post every day. So I think it's consistency.
So there we go.
It's consistency. So I don't go a day. Very rarely will I go a day without posting something.
Yeah. And is that on a story or just generally?
I think, but again, it's not like I'm spending hours on it, but I do post every day.
Yeah.
Even if it's like I've spent 10 minutes editing something or I've taken a little, whatever it is, story post. It's a combination, but genuinely every day. So I think I haven't really had any days where I haven't. And I don't treat it as a job. I just, it's, for me, it's, I think I would like to say I post the same now with 45,000 followers, which is a bit mad. That, and I posted the same when I had like maybe 40 followers. Genuinely, I don't think I've changed it too much.
Just touching on that, how do you feel about having 45,000 people follow you? That's crazy.
I'm not going to lie, it is a bit crazy. I don't really think about it very much. I don't know. I just don't know that many people. Like, I know about 100 people, and that's like a lot of people to me. It is quite surreal, and I think I've noticed it. I mean, if my husband was here, he would tell you all these stories, but I keep getting recognized, and that's interesting because I don't know how to deal with that. Obviously, you don't get taught how to deal with stuff like that. And it's lovely, actually. It's very, very positive interactions that I've had a lot in India. Okay. The demographic is generally people who are like me. Like, you know, yeah, I would say the age range between like 20s, 30s, 40s. And people are just really inspired by me sharing stuff about, you know, their home city or their food or dancing or whatever. So it is really nice. It's just I don't know how to deal with it. So I'm just like, oh, I can't believe you recognize me. That's really interesting. And it happened recently in Covent Garden. And I think that's like the busiest place in London. So that was a bit mad.
That's incredible.
Yeah, which it is lovely. And I think people obviously do feel some sort of connection to whatever it is. And also find me approachable enough that they're not, you know, just like maybe seeing me and they're not saying anything. I think people do come up and they'll be like, oh my God, I really like that you do this. And they'll be very specific. I think some of my friends are now making fun of me that I'm a celebrity. And I'm like, I don't think it is that. I just think people do feel connected to whatever it is that I'm sharing. Mm. But to me, I'm not trying to be a certain person. That is what you see online is actually just me.
Yeah.
I don't think I have any filters that I put on or off. If I really am like down about stuff, I will share that as well. Like, and as I will when I'm, you know, if things are going really well.
Yeah. And you touched on like the Bengali community and like your culture and how that's influenced obviously a lot of what you post. For those that don't know, like the Bengali community, obviously it's a huge part of the South Asian community in general. How's that different from all the other sort of communities that,
oh,
that
sit there? That's a whole episode in itself, I feel. Bengalis are, I mean, I'm talking about East and West Bengal here. Obviously it was partitioned by our colonial past, which was a very horrific incident my family were affected by. But I think Bengalis are a very creative, resourceful group of people. That's just, you know, if I was to sum it up, I think Bengal at some point, again, I don't want to get into facts because I might not be quoting the right numbers or whatever, but Bengal did make up for a pretty sizable chunk of the world's GDP at some point before colonial rule. So there was a lot happening, whether that be textiles or fabrics or education or literature or poetry or whatever it is. And then post-partition, it was plummeted into, you know, this horrible state where the city was just ripped in half, right? And then there was Bangladesh and West Bengal, and there's a lot of other subsections. I just think as people, it's an incredible community, and I love that I can add something to that, genuinely, because I'm so proud of being Bengali. It's something I've never shied away from. I've grown up in the UK, and there has been times I've been bullied in school, or I've been, you know, people have found my food smelly or like my outfit's weird or whatever, and I don't think I ever really shied away from it. And I think post-university, I really started to be like, I'm really proud of this, whatever it is. And even if it is having, you know, I come from a very liberal family, I would say. Bengali women throughout history, especially now, I think we're very like ostracized in like lots of ways of like being too opinionated and making all the men listen to us. And I'm like, this is great. Like, we should be proud of this. But it is a thing. It's a perception that really exists. There's this massive thing in India of like kala jadu and like Bengali women being really good at this. And like, I don't know, whatever. But I think, honestly, if I was able to do kala jadu, I'd be great. I think that's a great skill to have. But I don't think that's, it's the thing of like, our women have a lot of opinions. Mm. And I think I'm really honing into that. And being part of this community is something I'm very, very proud of. And I don't really want to differentiate between East and West Bengal because my family, like I said, come from both sides. And I think what people don't know, and it does differentiate us from some other parts of Indian community, is that there's very distinct food, way we use things, way our fabrics are done and the textiles are done. And yeah, I think it is quite distinctive. And because I focus on food, East Bengal and West Bengal have really distinct food styles, which you won't imagine. You just think Bengali food's one thing. It's really not. It's so many different things. And I'm, yeah, increasingly more proud of that.
I think when a lot of people go to an Indian restaurant, they know about like the thick, creamy curries or like tomato-based curries and big naans and meat and kind of maybe very tasty vegetarian food and paneer, like the Indian cheese. What's like a classic dish from like Bengali cuisine, which you'd say like that you maybe make at home that you go, this is really different and this is why? And
so, okay, when people think of Indian food, we're talking about the UK, right? Or a Western audience, they think of North Indian Punjabi food. That's predominantly the kind of migration of food that happened. And it's delicious. I love it too. But that's not what people really eat in their homes. It was a big thing. I remember growing up in school, of people thinking that's what you just eat at home. Like you're eating butter chicken or like, I don't know, jalfrezi or whatever. I'm like, first of all, I don't even know these dishes. Like, what are these dishes? My parents don't know how to make them. Bengali food is a lot lighter, I would say, in general. We don't use, I mean, if we're getting like nitty gritty with like food stuff, we don't really use that many powdered spices. Onion, garlic don't really make up for the basis of the food. We hardly use it. Actually,
yeah.
And I think if you ask me why, I can't give you an exact answer, but I think it's something to do with the climate, because it's so humid and it's much closer to like a river estuary. I think that's what it is. But if there's a dish, I don't know, I'd have to say there's a dish called machajol, which is not a one specific dish, but it's a fish broth. I'm refraining from using the word curry because most Indians don't eat curry. Because curry is kind of like saying sauce.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, this dish isn't that. It's a very brothy dish. I would say a bit more similar to like a pho or like a ramen.
Okay.
But using fish and very minimal spicing, some potatoes and aubergines in there. And it's something that we eat very regularly at home. I love it. I probably eat it like 3-4 times a week if I can. When I'm in Kolkata, I definitely eat it basically every day. It's like a very easy way to have a very full meal, and that's what we eat at home. And if you're looking away from fish, it's usually a lot of like greens. We eat a lot of cooked down greens, loads of different varieties and dishes, and I think our food is quite distinctive. I would say this most similar cuisine I personally find in India is probably Keralan food.
Okay.
So there's a lot of similarities to me, like having been to Kerala and then obviously eating Bengali food.
And for those who don't know, Kerala's South India.
Yeah, right? Kerala's like Southwest. Yeah. So there's a lot of similarities. Again, probably because it's coastal, a lot of fish, lighter food because you're not in like a dry, arid region. India's huge, right? So I think the cuisine is really determined by the geography a lot of the times, and the spices used and the temperature and all of those things. So as people in the South Asian continent, eat very depending on where we are and what the weather's like and what's around us. So I really love that about our culture, I think, because it's not like everyone's eating the same thing ever. And you move like 20 kilometers or miles and the food's different, or the way you make it is different. And that's the beauty of it for me. And I really like focusing on this in my work, especially even at events and stuff, because I don't want people to come in and get the same food all the time. The beauty of our cuisine and what I'm trying to do is that show off home food, And the beauty of showing that off is that there's no strict recipes. We're actually, as people, we're encouraged to be creative. We're encouraged to like cook with what's around us and like adapt to our environment. So when people come eat with me, I want them to be aware of that. They're not getting like the same recipe tried and tested every single time. They're getting the food that I'm interpreting from that week. If the weather's really hot, I might make something different. If it's really rainy, I might change something up. So I think the people who come eat with me, they know that. And that's something that I'm like really proud of as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why your supper clubs are probably so successful, because someone can come four or five times and actually experience something
so different.
Yeah,
the food is so different every single time. I like to say that even if I have the same events, like I had one last week, one this week, the menu is the same in essence, but it might taste quite different because, again, like I said, it depends on my mood, it depends on the weather, it depends what I've been up to that week. The structure is roughly the same, obviously. But eventually I want to get to a stage where I just, you know, I'm the Bengali omakase chef. Mm-hmm. And they come in and they just trust me to make them food.
I really like how your page and like your business reflects who you are as a person. And you've mentioned so many times already, like, it's just me. Like, I'm just posting this, and I'm talking about this, and this is what I found this week. And there was, when you were back home, I think a few months ago now, you were looking at like different ingredients, mm-hmm. and it was sort of assessing them. Do you want to use this one? Do you want to use that one? And it's very like entrepreneurship generally, even for other, I mean, even like my accountancy practice or consultancy firm, whatever. Businesses do reflect like the personality of the owners quite a lot. And I think a lot of people try and shy away from that a little bit. You know, they kind of go, well, no, like business is like this, and accountants should be like this, and lawyers should be like this, and this person should be like this. Whereas very often, actually, if you come across as, if you just be who you are, actually, that is a recipe for success, right?
Yeah, I think so. For me, it's quite natural. I think when I started, maybe it wasn't as natural, potentially, because like you were saying, I thought it had to be, this is work, this is me, kind of stay separate. But I think as I've grown, I've realized what makes it special is me, actually, in whatever capacity that is. So the business, the brand, it's me. It's not like I'm trying to do something that's like out of my comfort zone, or like I'm not trying to emulate any other culture. And even sometimes I do say, like, I'm not trying to speak for every Indian person, because again, I'm speaking for a very particular city, way I've grown up. It's me. It's not. And also, I don't want to be the spokesperson of any culture. If people relate to me, that's lovely. But I'm not doing it to be relatable. And I think I always want to carry that forward, even with the brands that I work with now. Sometimes, like, if I really don't identify with something, I probably, it won't come across, basically. And I've done that quite a few times. I've rejected things, or I've tried it, and then it's been like, why am I doing this? Like, it doesn't work with who I am. But then there's some things that fit really well, even if other people might think it doesn't fit well. And then it's ended up being like really, really successful. I think I just really believe, like, with what I'm trying to do.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team, or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
And with Smoke and Lime, which may eventually just be under my name, because Smoke and Lime was very, I literally just came up with it as something to call the supper club when I started.
Why is it cool? Why did you come up with it?
Honestly, it was just a brainstorming session. A lot of people have asked me this, like, well, what's Smoke and Lime? And I'm like, I just came up with it at the time. Like I said, it wasn't meant to be like my life plan. It was just fun at the time. And we came, I do use a lot of lime in my food, and I like smoking a lot of my food. Not smoking, but like smoking on a barbecue.
Yeah.
I'm not smoking any food. So I think it's a nice fit, but at some point I would like the brand to just be me, because that is what is most authentic. So it is, for me, it is a very natural thing. I don't know. I don't want it to become some like alien brand that I have to go in and out of and like pretend I'm in it and I'm not in it. Even with the brand partnerships or where I'm going with the business, like it should be because I want to do that.
I always try and encourage clients to push their personality into the business, because people relate to that. People understand it. And sometimes people have like a perception of like what a business person should be like or what entrepreneurs should be like. But it's just a status. Like we were kind of saying the other day, earlier today, you compared to some of the other guests on the podcast. I mean, our first guest was this wonderful gentleman, Matthew King. Extremely intelligent guy, but investment banker, now runs his own sort of advisory shop. And he's suited and booted and sort of, he's a very relaxed character, to be fair, as well. But he's suited and booted sitting in sort of Westminster in a lovely office. We've got Ryan Trix, who's a big influencer, magician, billions of views across his videos. I mean, he definitely doesn't sit at a desk for sure, unless he's editing. I think even then he would probably walk around his apartment. And then obviously yourself, where you've got the like creative element of cooking and dancing and obviously posting on your social media bits, and you're all entrepreneurs in your own right, but you all have the personality to show to the market, so they come back and go, yeah, we like this and we'll follow you, or we'll do business with you, mm-hmm. or we'll come to a supper club.
Yeah, I agree. I actually grew up with a lot of really strong personalities around me. Immediately, both my parents are actually very strong personalities. So I think that coupled with, I also grew up with a lot of fame around me. And actually, I don't think I've ever discussed this before, but your conversation just made it come up for me. My dad is very heavily involved in the Indian classical music scene in India, and I grew up with seeing a lot of very, very famous people in that world, obviously, but also globally famous people. So I think the one thing that I've always found really, really just like inspiring and attractive is seeing people's actual personalities shine through. And I've never shied away from like showing that off. Maybe as a result of that, I don't know. Like, I never feel like intimidated by seeing like really big personalities around me, or like I don't really feel starstruck for a lot of those reasons as well. And then so to me, it's very normal to kind of emulate your personality into your whatever you're doing, if it's creative or, you know, business or education, whatever it is. So maybe it's one of those things, I don't know, that I've imbibed from like growing up with that around me.
What I want to get into now a little bit, if you don't mind, is the bloody hard work that goes into everything, because I want people to get a genuine image of you, because what we've heard so far is this wonderful creative dancer, cook, fun side to you, which obviously will always remain. But you touched on it with sort of consistency and like posting every day and thinking about your business and building the brand over 8 years. There's a lot of work that goes into this.
Yeah, there is a lot of work. Again, this is one of those things I never reflect on, because to me it never really feels like work, but it is work, of course. And I'm very lucky and blessed to be able to call my passion my work, and vice versa. But it's a lot of hours. I'm actually trying to get into this space a little bit more, because I get asked a lot by people who are trying to start up their own food business or supper clubs. And I want to mentor people. I really enjoy mentoring people. I think I've always enjoyed teaching to some aspect. I'm not a trained chef. I didn't really go to culinary school or anything. I like to really hone in and say that I've been in the cooking school of my mom and my grandma, my aunties, because South Asian women and like the stuff they do at home is more hard work than you can ever do in any other setting, genuinely. And that has my highest respect. I've seen my own mom do it. She's an incredible, incredible cook. And not just the cooking, it's just the, it's the hard work. So whenever I think I'm working hard, I'm like, yeah, but the, you know, I've seen how much my mom worked, like endlessly. And again, conventionally, she didn't have a job, but there's no switching off for homemakers, if yeah, that's what we're,
well, absolutely,
you know, men or women, predominantly women in our diaspora. But I feel like for what I do, a lot of it is paying respect to that. I want people to, in whatever capacity, if they come to my events, they see my videos or they eat my food, I want them to be thankful of those people that have endlessly worked in the background without any recognition. And if I can make them consider that for like a minute, I feel like I'm successful, you know, genuinely. But talking about myself, honestly, yeah, there's a lot of work. I cook a lot, like a lot. And I don't tell myself that very often, but even when I'm not working for a particular event or, you know, whatever it is, I'm cooking like a lot, or I'm thinking about cooking, or I'm buying ingredients. I do everything myself. And I have been doing that consistently. Like I said, the main thing is that I've been doing on average, three supper clubs a month since 2018. It's a lot of hours. And I haven't really, it obviously had to stop during COVID. But even during COVID, like I did cooking, like I dropped food off at people's houses. I started a little catering business literally from my flat. I taught cooking online. So there's a lot that goes just behind the scenes of running a supper club. I think there's a bit of it is kind of trending on social media right now, of like people just hosting supper clubs. Consistency is the main, yeah. Like I think if you can keep doing that, not getting tired, not letting it burn out, that's the key. And I don't think it's like, I'm very glad I can like kind of hustle and do that, because I've never been, I think there have been moments, especially like financially, where I've been like, oh, I'm just going to quit and I'll go get a full-time job in, I don't know, consulting, because that's what I used to do before this. And then I've had an event and I've just seen people's faces light up and I'm like, no, I'm good at this. So you just keep going and you keep going. And for me, I have not stopped, regardless of the bumps and the even geographical changes. Me and my husband, we lived in Australia for a couple of years, just less than that. I did my business from scratch there. I didn't know anyone, didn't have colleagues, didn't have friends really, and managed to, within 6-7 months, have sellout events. From having no community. London was always easier because I know people who live in the city, right? But I think that gave me that confidence of like, I'm good at this, so I'm just going to keep going. I treat cooking very much as, there's a like a Hindi word, Bengali word called riyaz, which is the practice of doing something. And again, because I'm a classical dancer, it comes very naturally to me to put in that work. You just have to keep, yeah. I don't know. That's probably my key message to anyone wanting to start something like this. You can't just do it on the day that you have an event. I feel like it kind of always has to be running in the background.
This is the bit. This is where people go, oh, I'm interested in cooking. But to do it to the level you're doing it at, there's a different level. And I want people to know, because some people might have heard three supper clubs a month. I mean, come on. Like,
yeah,
it's three nights every 30 days. I mean, come on average. That doesn't sound like a lot, but I know that's crazy.
Yeah.
So let's give a flavor. So let's say you've got a sub club next week.
Yeah.
What would you do from now until, let's say, next Wednesday? I know it's Tuesday today. So what would you do over the next 8 days to prepare for that?
Well, actually, no. So let's turn that a little bit. So I actually do have, I have two events literally this week. So, okay, let's take it. So I've got an event this Thursday and I've got one on Saturday. Two different menus, actually. So two different 7-course menus. Firstly, I think just the main thing is, because I've been doing this for supper clubs are about to be 7 years. All the menus and the food that I cook, it's in the back of my brain. Like, there's knowledge that I've gathered from, I don't know, hours of watching YouTube videos, reading books, listening to podcasts, lots of different things, traveling to different parts of India. So that's already time that's in the bank, right? Then there's the regular cooking that I do. I cook in a cafe once a week. Sometimes I practice, but like, I put ideas into play if I'm cooking somewhere during the week that's not part of the supper club. In terms of a week's rundown, firstly, I don't know, I make a bit of an email list. I have to most of the time contact the people that have booked or check the booking platform, check for any dietaries. Then there's making a list of ingredients. I buy all the ingredients myself. I don't do like online orders and stuff. And that's something I'm like, I really enjoy. It's part of the prep that I enjoy. So I'll go to honestly different parts of London, buying stuff, carrying it home with me on a bus. So there's a lot of time, again, already adding into it, right? That people don't really see when they've just seen an event has happened. All events are pretty much in our flat. So in my home space. So there's the cleaning. There's just general like upkeep, setup, laundry. I don't know. All of these things do add up. Then obviously making the food. Usually I do that like on the day. There'll be some elements I do like maybe the evening before. So doing 2 to 3 events a week is like 7 days of work, like very easily. So I actually had someone ask me maybe a week ago. They were asking me how many supper clubs I do. And I said, oh, you know, summer's really busy because, and I really thought I pushed myself in July, possibly a bit too much. There was a couple of weeks where I literally had like, I think 8 events in the space of like 10, 11 days.
Whoa.
It was a lot. And yeah. I, at the end of that week was the first time, I think in a long time, I really felt like I didn't want to cook anymore. Just, I was like, I just need a day to sit down and not be around the gas or like cleaning up. And then I was telling someone this and they were like, oh, but like, you know, what do you do the rest of the time? And I'm like, okay, but this is, it's a creative career. If I'm constantly cooking, I'm going to burn out like very quickly because there's no more ideas that are going to come. And I again, the type of branded business I'm running, I don't want to just like make food for the sake of making food. Like, I think it would come across to my guests. I don't want to be on this autopilot of like, here's a menu. I've made it for you. Off you go. You've paid me money. That's not what I'm doing. If I was doing that, I'd run a restaurant, genuinely speaking, because then I can pass it on to other people at least. This is all me and my energy. So if my energy is not there, it will come across. So yeah, it is interesting. I think a lot of times when I've applied to do like events in spaces, there's obviously that chat of fees and payment that we will hopefully touch upon. People just see like, here's the menu cost. Here's the ingredients cost. Why are you charging this much money? And I'm like, okay, but I've been putting in like 10 years of work into this. So my brain is in that position to be able to make all this food, teach you about this culture. And there's a lot of work that's gone into that. So I don't think people really appreciate that very often. They'll just be like, why are you charging this much? And I've had it very often.
Yeah.
Especially for smaller catering things where people are like, I don't know, it's a very common thing. And people will hope, I think, relate to this. They'll be like, oh, well, our budget's like, what, £25 a head? Like that, like for a private chef to come and do that for you, it doesn't make any sense for me because in London, and again, I'm being specific to London, £25 is like a sandwich and chips, let's be honest. And like what I'm doing is putting in years of effort and work and knowledge and my kind of usage of spices and condiments and all of these things I've been honing my skill in. It would make zero sense for me to do something like that. But people don't get it. They're probably just thinking I'm being expensive. But the kind of background work that goes into it is quite unnoticed, I think, with a lot of creative arts.
Yeah. And I guess it's to some extent like the unknown because I don't know how good your food is. And so when you say like, I cook's amazing Bengali food, they're sort of like, is it Indian food? What are you talking about? And then only at the moment, as you said before, they actually put the food in their mouth and they go, oh my God, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Do they go, okay, the price is worth it? And to get to that stage is
this is why, I, to be honest, you know, I always think this, especially with social media and stuff. Again, like, you know, we're talking about all these followers and whatnot. I find it really hard to convey what one of my events is like on social media because there's no way you can tell. People can't taste things. They can't smell things. They can't feel the atmosphere. So coming to a supper club or any of these like smaller events, like there's a feeling.
Did you know you can save up to 70% on the best brands just by shopping at FromRebel.com? We're talking about strollers, car seats, high chairs, espresso machines, cookware, everything you need for way less. Here's how it works. Every single day, Rebel drops thousands of new products on the site for up to 70% off. It is a constant stream of endless deals from top brands like Abba Baby, Nuna, Baby Bjorn, Breville, Nespresso, KitchenAid, Le Creuset, and more. But you have to act fast because every deal is one of a kind. So if you see something you love, make sure you add to cart fast. So stop paying full price when you don't have to. Whether it's baby gear, kitchen upgrades, or a treasure for your home you didn't know you needed, Rebel has it for way less, up to 70% less. Shop from Rebel.com and save big.
There's no way anything can capture that. And I know, again, if we're talking about price points, yeah, it is a fairly expensive experience. But when you, I've never had anyone who's come to an event and then been like, oh, it's expensive. Yeah. If anything, they're always like, this is just a random piece of information, but like I write menus that are like 5-6 courses. You actually get way more than that most of the time on the day because there'll be dishes I've made that I just feel like making and I've given it to you to try. Because you're coming into my home, I'm hosting you, but I can't write that down, you know? So, and even at events I've catered for, like I will always go above and beyond. That's just me. And it's how I've been brought up. It's how the community I come from present itself. And I also don't want to be stingy. That's like, my mom would literally give me a slap if she found out. There's like one big thing of like, I can actually speak for all South Asians when I say this, that you should never run out of food.
Yeah.
I literally last week, I had three people who are like friends of mine. They wanted to come to a supper club. I was sold out. I told them to come at the end of the night and they can just eat. And they were just like, oh my God, how come you have extra food? I'm like, because like, I can't do like small things. Like it has to come from the heart and this comes from the heart. So I think people don't really get that, especially on social media or even on emails. It doesn't really come across that is part of the culture that I'm sharing and I'm oversharing probably to some level. But I'm really proud of that. I never want to be like, you get this one spoon of rice and that's the end of your meal. Like, there's been events where like, you know, people eat varying amounts of food in different groups. First, you have to be ready to make that. But I never want someone to be like, can I have a bit more? And I'm like, oh, sorry, I don't have any. That's not going to happen.
You're always like, yeah, it has two more.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of a supper club for me. Like from when I started doing supper clubs, that was what drew me to it. That it's like you're being hosted at your favorite auntie's house. That's what I want to be. Like sometimes people take away food sometimes for lunch next day. And I'm like, I love that. You're going into office with my food. It's great. So I don't want to be the fine dining chef. And I will say the food I cook is fine dining, but I don't want to be in that zone where it's like, you just get this tiny bit of whatever it is you're getting and that's your experience. No, like if you want another box for food later, like take it, like have it, enjoy it with your kids.
So it sounds like you probably won't open a restaurant.
I really don't. I know. When I started, I did really want a restaurant because I think that's what I knew. That's what, when you go into food, it's kind of like the only thing you see. So I didn't really know any different. I think there's reasons I don't want to run a restaurant. Firstly, I just don't think it's for me. I'm going to be very honest and say, I love my work. I love cooking. I also have a separate life to that. Like there's dancing, there's watching movies. There's a lot of things. I don't want to be working 24/7. It's just not me. Running a restaurant, I think people who do it, honestly, kudos to them. It's 24/7 work. I've worked with someone who's a restaurant founder. I'd never seen that person switch off. And that's great on them that they were able to do that. I don't think that's me. And I would be that person that would burn out in like a year and be like, I'm done, because I would put my heart and soul into it. I'm very over the top with that. I just don't think a restaurant would translate what I'm trying to do into the wider community. I don't want other people to cook my food. My food is really good because I'm cooking it. Yeah. I think that's kind of where it stands. And I don't want to be in a restaurant kitchen shut away, really, from not cooking my food. What I do imagine possibly, and you know, we were chatting about this, is having a bit of a community cafe or a community space where I can be making fresh food for people, almost like a canteen, and they can come and we can hang out. And that's the food they get because that's what's available on the day. Actually, I want to cut into another thing because I have been in the hospitality industry for the last 10 years. I have seen so many of my really close friends and colleagues like burn out, go through really traumatic situations, really horrible financial situations. And I've seen the flip side of it and I've seen what's happened to them. in a good or a bad way. And I think that I just don't see myself wanting to go through that at all. I think what I'm doing is a much more bespoke, educational and kind of translatable experience in like building community and like taking our food forward in a very specific way that's not serving restaurant dishes.
I really distinctly remember the first time Yesha, my wife, came home and she had your food and she was like, she's usually pretty animated as some audience members know, but there's a different way and feel that she came back from that night, because she wasn't just talking about how great the food was. She was talking about the atmosphere, the energy, obviously meeting your husband as well. Yeah. He's a bit of an unsung hero here. I mean, I've got a bat for husbands. He is an unsung
hero for sure.
What a man. What a man.
He's amazing.
And I know he helps like in the background kind of look after the guests and do a whole host of other things, I'm sure. And he's also like super smart as well. Like,
he's a doctor. He's a psychiatrist.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So he's everything. So that kind of atmosphere where you're in someone's home, 10, 15 of you can really get to know people, you can kind of hear over conversations, join in, compared to like a restaurant where you've probably got a group of you or you're going out with your lovely partner or whatever. And whilst that is fun, it is restricted to that kind of
I think supper clubs just have their own little community. Genuinely, I think, again, when I discovered it back in like 2016, I was really blown away, because here's this space that firstly people can be comfortable in. They can meet people. That's been a big part of it for me since day one, actually, of like having... London's a hard city, right? It's a really busy city. It's a hard city. If you don't have your group of people, sometimes it's quite lonely. And I think I wasn't born and brought up in London, right? So I moved here, kind of experienced that some part of that myself. What I wanted to create was this space where people can come and, again, pretend like you're just at a relative's house or something. You can sit on the sofa. We literally say this at the beginning of every supper club: our flat becomes yours for that evening. Eat to your heart's content. Eat with your hands. Like, there's not that kind of barrier that you would have in a slightly more formal setting. And I think having things in your flat or home really helps that cause. Like I said, it's really hard to explain that feeling of hosting a supper club and also being part of one. I've been part of so many people's supper clubs as well. It's a magical space that you just feel like transported to, like this kind of almost slightly older way of living to some level, where someone's cooking for you, they're caring for you, and you get to meet all these lovely people. I love building that kind of network of friendships. There's so many people who've like met at my supper clubs. Now they're like at each other's weddings and like part of each other's lives. And even I've had that, like I've made friends that then I've gone to their weddings, or now I'm like looking after their kids, and it's amazing.
Yeah, wow.
So that goes beyond the food. And I think food is the best vehicle to get into that zone. Again, I grew up in a house where food was literally at the center, and food has that ability to like not just start conversations but create these like really special spaces, and just trying to take that forward, really. Because I grew up in a house that happened, and my mum always was ready for like 10 people to show up on an evening, genuinely. You know, friends or whatever. Like, if they came, there'd be food and you'd hang out and it would be amazing. And my grandma did that, and both my grandmas, sorry, my mum's mum, my dad's mum. So it's a way of living. And I think it's also the art of hosting, which I'm trying. I don't know, like, I feel like it is dying out, and I really want to hold on to it a little bit. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Laura.
And I'm Adam.
And we're the hosts of the Persuasion Game podcast.
Each episode, we meet with marketers and business leaders to understand how they grow their brands and influence their consumers.
You recently pulled out three principles to great portfolio strategy. Are you able to sort of summarize those?
And show you're working.
I'll do my best.
For more of the strategy behind how brands persuade their consumers, listen to the Persuasion Game
wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to take a sharp right turn, if you don't mind.
Let's go.
Because for all this amazing creativity to you, you're also academically unbelievable. I mean, you've got a master's.
I was. I don't know if I have anymore.
Well, you've got a master's in business and economics from the London School of Economics. Like, that's not...
International Health Policy.
International Health Policy. Apologies. Yeah. I mean, that's no small, like, feat. So, like, the LSE is huge. Like it's phenomenal. It's one of the best universities in the world. So let's just combine all this creativity with this academic brilliance for a moment. Let's just appreciate you for a second. But back when you were sort of doing that master's, I presume you didn't envisage your life going down the supper club route and, you know, tens of thousands of followers. You were looking more sort of corporate, maybe hospitality kind of space.
I was looking at corporate. I'll take you back to my 16-year-old self. I was like, I'm going to do economics. I'm going to go to LSE. I'm going to have an office and I'm going to be the CEO of some company.
Awesome.
Firstly, no one has offices anymore because everyone's hot desking. So that dream would not have worked out because I would love like my own cabin. It's not going to happen. And I think as soon as I got into that office space, I was like, wow, like I just don't really fit in here. Like there was lots of things. I worked in a consulting firm after I graduated. There's so many things. Firstly, I just don't think I'm very good at sitting down and working on a laptop. Very bad at that. I'm very, like, I don't know. I think I was always meant for a vocational degree, which I didn't do. And then I think there was lots of things like actually the drinking culture, the kind of party, like, you know, work hard, play hard situation. It's just not me. Not really like, I don't know, valuing your like personal life versus your work life. Like that was a big thing in the firm that I worked at least. And it just didn't really sit right with me. So I think I got very disenchanted very quickly. And I have spoken about this a lot before, but I went through a really horrible period of depression, which was for a while. And a lot of that was to do with my job. And the kind of lifestyle that required, which I wasn't really equipped for. Food was really never part of the, I don't know, I just never really cooked. Like I cooked for myself, but that's it. It came in, I think almost by chance. I worked randomly for free in a few restaurants, because I reached out and like wanted to do some stuff on the side. And it really did fall into my lap when I met Asma through someone else. Who is still really a key person in my life and supports a lot of things. And that's when I saw there's this like almost creative world, which I know a lot of hospitality isn't, but this part of what Asma was doing really was, and it spoke out to me. And I think through the years, I've just tried to incorporate that with, yeah, me as a person. Because, yeah, I think the corporate life, sadly, was not for me. I wish it was, it's not.
Well, it's not for everyone, and it's a very formulaic way to kind of live your life. And a lot of people like that. Like they'd be able to, I mean, okay, I've worked for a massive accountancy firm, but like you could plan out your 30 year career, 40 year career there.
Exactly.
Even with salaries and everything, it was crazy, but that's what they offered. They offered assurance. They offered like to some extent a nice pathway. If you tick these boxes and jump through these loopholes, you will get to
I think
to
that is the thing.
Level.
And that's what we're all taught. And I think I can maybe speak for both of us on this particular bit because growing up like South Asian or British South Asian, it's just a really normal path. And no one really thinks outside of that. I think so. My dad's a doctor. My mom, like I said, is a homemaker, also an amazing chef, I would say. And it was, they just didn't know. It's not like that was a conversation because it's just, what do you even talk about? It's just, firstly, it was crazy that I wasn't doing medicine because all my friends were studying medicine. So economics itself was like, oh my God, like, whoa. What is she doing? It's so alternative. So, and to me, that wasn't alternative. That was like, you know, a lot of people do economics. And then it was after, you know, I initially actually didn't even tell my parents when I quit my job. I was just like, I'm going to figure something out. Luckily got a really amazing job in a Michelin restaurant. I think I was overqualified for that job by far, but it gave me a salary. And to me, that was normal of like having a salary that you get at the end of every month. And now I don't do that. I'm a freelance chef, right? So it's every month is entirely different. But it takes so much getting used to, and we're not taught that as definitely not a South Asian diaspora. Like, it's just you have a salary, you have a pension, this is your life. So even now to most of my community, friends, family, definitely immediate family, it's so alien what I do because they don't understand when I'm not working that it's freelance and maybe I've worked and got maybe double what a salary would look like in one project, right? But people just don't know and we're not kind of armored with that knowledge. I've had to discover all of that myself and teach myself. And the degree probably helped in doing that a little bit to some level, at least having that understanding of a business.
And how did you find that transition? Like going from like a salary and then go like...
I still find it weird. And it's, I've not had a salary for like 5 years now. And I still find it really strange. I mean, again, Rigel, my husband, like he would tell you like every few months, I'm like, oh, maybe I should just go work in a bank. Because like, yeah, to me, it is alien. Like the freelance life is very like seasonal. So, like summer's really busy. Like I'm probably earning triple what a normal London salary average might look like, and then some months in winter have no work. So it is really volatile, and it takes a lot of like mental getting used to, and I don't know if I'm still used to that, to be honest. It takes me a step back to be like, oh, like this month I have no money, but then next month I might have double that amount. So it is, yeah, I don't know if I'm used to it actually. It's a weird one.
You don't ever get used to it, to be honest with
you. I probably am now, like this year, I probably am a bit more used to it. But up until very recently, it is a juggle, and it's a kind of forecasting and planning your year a little bit more, because now I've made it a bit of a point to go stay in India for a couple of months of the year because I want to cook in India like actively. I want to add back to the culture that I come from. So I have to then take that into account with my UK finances to be like, okay, I'm taking 2 months out. Obviously, I still have to pay rent. But I'm going to go live in India. I'm going to maybe earn some money there, but it's, you know, the currency situation is very different. So there's a lot of like forward planning that you have to do. And probably to some level, the degrees maybe help with that. I don't know. My dad, when he still gets asked what I do, he mentions LSE first. That's what everyone knows about me.
He's a good South Asian dad.
He's like, she went to LSE. And then eventually 20 minutes later, he'll be like, I think she's an entrepreneur. And I'm like, yep. Yeah, That's it. You don't tell them what I do. That's fine. Keep them guessing.
Well, they can just Google you.
Yeah, they can. Actually, that's why I should start saying Google me.
Yeah, you'll figure it out.
You'll figure it out what I do. But it is, I think, with family. Oh, actually, most of my family in India think I have a restaurant.
And how have you found managing those expectations? Because, like, again, actually talking to a soon-to-be-issued episode with Moyes, he articulately put that, you know, South Asian parents, they have a level of expectation for you, and it's doubled down in that you can't just get any job. It has to be like a certain kind of job that they can tell people about, because there's a lot about presenting to the community. And even when it comes to him, he's a young, very handsome 27-year-old, so but he's engaged now, sorry ladies, he's got a wonderful girlfriend, but he is you know, you have to be presented for marriage at some point if there's an arranged kind of situation or whatever. But it's all about how things look and perceptions and all that kind of stuff. Have you ever felt sort of, you know, having to fight that a little bit and go...
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I think, again, like I said, my parents are, you know, in the grand scheme of parents, probably quite chill. I'm an eldest daughter in the family, which I think, you know, for South Asians, that's quite a, yeah, if you have a, I have a younger brother. So like, I feel a lot of responsibility, generally speaking, not financially, but just probably emotionally most of the time. I definitely felt at times, probably it's more a battle with myself of like having to prove stuff, which I constantly do. I think it is very interesting because to me, I've always, since I started doing supper clubs, I feel like I've been doing well because it's mad that people are paying for my food, right? So for me, it's always like, yay, wow. But then when I translate that to like parents or family, I feel like only recently has that started probably paying off, because now they can be like, oh, she was on this newspaper and she was on this magazine. And there's like actual assets. Whereas to me, that I don't think matters as much. But I have felt in myself that when I've had conversations, I'm trying to really, you know, be like, oh, guess what? Like I got interviewed for this thing and I'm doing, because that to them is like a translatable thing of like success equals this, right? Which didn't exist before, obviously. And now I think my parents do take me a bit more seriously, probably because people recognize me, like I said. And if they've told someone about me, they're like, oh yeah, that's your daughter. Like, so yeah, it's that sort of tie-in, which didn't happen honestly even till 2 years ago. So now when I speak to them, I think there's a part of me that probably boasts a bit more about the stuff that I've done that actually has, like, I don't know, a representation in media or print or whatever it is. But to me, I don't think it matters as much.
It's really interesting because when you think about the amount of work you've had to put in over the last 8, 9, 10 years, and you're like building yourself into something amazing, obviously it doesn't happen overnight. But that process of spending years to do it, I mean, you have to pay your dues in the entrepreneurial world. It's quite rare that you come across an idea and you're really successful tomorrow. Whereas when you get a job, it really is kind of like that. Because you're
instant.
You get the recognition, or you know, if you get into work for Goldman Sachs or whatever, it's like, oh, he works for Goldman Sachs. You could be the most junior guy there.
This is the thing, yeah.
But everyone's like, oh my God, that's a great company to work for. And it's just like, yeah, but he's... you know, he's like the junior person, whereas you're a super successful entrepreneur. But because very few people might have heard of that, they go, oh, well, who should we value more? And it's
That is so interesting. That happens in so many social settings, especially South Asian social settings. Oh my gosh, I can't even. There's so many. I think I block these conversations out of my head.
Yeah,
because they'll be like, oh yeah, she's cooking. And then it's like, oh, but this person works at, like, a, you know, junior intern at JP Morgan or whatever. And I'm like, I know what that is. Probably not great.
Yeah. And it's just like, and it's, I feel sometimes I have to bat for business owners, because it's not everyone's going to be like recognized, like, you know, Elon Musk or Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or whatever.
Exactly.
It's, but you can be extremely successful, way more successful than those guys. Just by living through your passion, as you said before, you don't have to have those like brand names associated with you. It's you know, you've got your own brand. Like, you are.
I am the brand. You. Exactly. That's
so,
it.
So I find it quite frustrating sometimes when people go, oh yeah, that person's like this amazing individual, and they've got a really good job. And don't get me wrong, it's difficult to get it, but this person runs a profitable business, hires like 5-10 people. And okay, fine, they're not making like £1 million a year, but they're still making great money and they're comfortable. And if you took their equivalent salary, it'd be like your boss's salary. So let's all just, you know, show some respect.
I think this is the thing. It's a lot of this, again, comes down to the salary thing we were talking about. It's not like I'm paying myself a salary, but like, I know, like, to me, the success is obviously these people who are booking for my events, they're literally coming into my home and sitting down and eating my food and paying for it. But there's also, I don't know, just the success of having done something that didn't exist. Like, Smoke and Lime doesn't exist without me. It didn't exist 8 years ago. It's something that I thought of, and now it's a thing.
Yeah.
And I made it a big thing, and I've made it a thing. So it is, for me, that's like the success part of it, but it's really hard to tell that to people. Yeah. I think sometimes.
And sorry, South Asian parents, but I think that position they have does come from a place of love, right? They want you to be secure. They want you to be safe.
It's the security. Yeah.
And they want you to have like a good salary, so that it's not just, oh, I can tell Auntie G over here, like, my son works for this. But it's so that they know, okay, you've got, like, you're settled, like, you're done.
Yeah.
Like,
I think a lot of it, I agree with this to some level as well. Like, for me, it's that, can I afford to live the way I live? That's it. Like, as a business owner, I'm, like, again, especially in hospitality, I'm not expecting to suddenly become, like, a millionaire. Really, it's so rare that that happens anyway. But for me, it's like, can I go on the holidays that I want? Can I fly to India a couple of times of the year? Because that's what I want to do. Can I spend time with my grandma? Can I have days off when I want to have? So that, if I can do that, I'm pretty happy. Like, you know, if I can go eat in this restaurant that I want to eat at, or like buy this amazing piece of cake that maybe costs £10 in London. Like, if I can do that, I'm very successful, I feel. And I have been able to do that for the last couple of years at least. And whether people see it or not, or they see the work behind it or not, I don't know if that matters as much. Sometimes it does matter when it's my parents or like immediate family being like, what are you doing? Like, with all your time. And I'm like, yeah, I'm working on things that will eventually happen. When I spend this time in India, so I've been spending January and February in India because the UK business side of things is really bad then. India's kind of booming. I've done some events in Kolkata now. I've had some newspaper articles. Honestly, I've had family members come and tell me, what's your husband doing in the UK? And I'm like, oh, he's working. And they're like, oh, but you're here. And I'm like, yeah, I'm working. So it's baffling to them because they don't see me like go to an office, right? So that there's like, what is she doing? She's just here, like, you know, kind cooking. Of cooking a bit of food for people, and he's there struggling by himself. Oh my gosh, what's going to happen to him?
Yeah.
And I'm like, he's an adult. He's fine. Yeah. He's very good, actually.
Yeah. He's a very adult.
Yeah, he's a very adult. He's great. And like, someone literally asked me if he was staying with his mum while I was away in India. And I was like, that would be really strange, actually, if he did that. But I don't think he's doing that because they live in different cities in the UK. And it's weird that you think that this person can't look after themselves. And I'm just here having a good time and neglecting my partner. And I'm sure he probably wouldn't get those questions anyway.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't mind me going down that road, because it's quite fascinating, because there was a period where earlier this year, Yesha was away. Mm. She was doing a few things, actually, for my lovely brother's wedding. She was going to India, buying a few bits for him. And I'm extremely grateful that she did that. But she was, I think she was away for about 3 weeks or a month.
Yeah.
And the amount of people that came up to me, they were like, are you eating okay? Are you, can we make you anything? And I was sort of like, I mean, I love my wife. Obviously, she's phenomenal. And she makes amazing food. Yeah. And generally, she does a bulk of the sort of home duties, and I'm more sort of working. But at the same time, if I was asked to cook, like, you know.
You can do it.
I'm okay. Like, it's fine. Or I can... If I'm feeling lazy, I can, you know, go on to
order or whatever. Again, we all have those privileges now to do that.
So it was just, it was really, and a lot of those questions came from, and it came out of love. Like, honestly, none of it was like, Rohit, you're going to burn like toast.
Yeah.
Like, let's just, here's some sub tea, here's some, you're going to be fine. But it was all just, it's really interesting to see like both sides of that. But between Yesha and I, obviously she was worried about me. She was like, are you eating okay? Are you doing? I was like, yeah, I have to deliver it. It's fine. Like, it's if I'm working late, I'll make sure it's fine.
So the funniest part of all of this is actually, so Rigel is just not like that. He's actually a really, like, he does most of the house chores most of the time anyway, even when I'm around. He's a very, and I say this really proudly, he's a really feminist man. Like,
yeah,
you know, obviously that's how he's been brought up as well, and it's his personality in that, but he is really like good at just looking after himself and me. We're both very equal in our home life, and also the business. Like, he's very much part of my business, and he's pretty integral in it, I would say. Like, he's the best spokesperson that I have for my food, because sometimes I find it really hard to explain what I do and what I'm cooking. But there's like two sides of the society aspect of this, where I think in South Asian societies, communities, especially I would say British Indian ones, where like people have moved here, it's very like, oh my God, like firstly, I'll be like, oh, you're not letting him do his work. He's doing your work. And secondly, he's supporting you so he can't like do his own stuff. And we both get that a lot. And it's so interesting because, and I'm sure Rajul won't mind me saying this, he just wants to make me famous so he can just like be like my manager husband. That's his main dream at the moment. He's playing the long game. And every now and then we get invited to these lovely restaurants and we get to eat this beautiful food that I can, you know, luckily have for free because I'm making a video for them or something. And he's like having the time of his life. And he's like, this is the life. This is what I want in life. So, yeah. And also alongside, he's a very hardworking doctor, as all of the doctors are in the NHS. So he does it very well. I don't think he needs me to like spoon feed him.
Yeah.
Ever.
Was that like a conversation you and him had where he was like, oh, don't worry, I'll do my share of the chores? Or was it just something that you fell into?
No, not really. We've actually been together a really long time. We started dating when we were students. So I think we've just done a lot of growing up together. So I don't think it was ever a conversation that we had to have. It was just
this needs to be cleaned. And
yeah, I feel like we're just very good at like living together and just doing things together. And a lot of that does come like if you've been with someone from a young age, you do that growing up together. So you kind of see what fits and what doesn't. And I don't remember ever having a conversation really. But also both of our families' credits, like we've both been brought up that way. That you do your own stuff and like you're self-sufficient. So yeah, I think that's credit to his parents on that part as well.
Absolutely. What a man.
Yeah, he's great. He's so good. So I think he'd be very happy here. He'd be like, I'm going to play this section on repeat.
Oh, we'll cut it. Tanya's already got all the little wheels lined up and sent it straight to you.
Yeah.
But it's always, when we talked before about how the business is a personal reflection of you, mm-hmm. because you imbue it with so much of who you are. But part of that is also your life, and your husband is a huge part
absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely. And we're hosting events at home. Like, actually, the conversation we did have is when I first started in supper clubs, Rigel wasn't meant to be as part of it, really. He was a junior, he's still a junior doctor. They're junior doctors for ages, but he was a much more junior doctor. He was like doing his F1, F2 years. So the conversation I think we did consciously have is, do I do all the events at home? He was absolutely up for that. So he's a very extroverted personality, probably more than me, actually. And secondly, I think when I first started, like I said, it wasn't meant to be like my full career, right? I was doing a full-time job and I was going to do this once a month. So it was meant to be, if he's around, he's going to help. If he's not around, I'll get a friend to help. And I think about 6 months in, he was like, I really enjoy doing this with you. So I want to be more like incorporated into it. And then I think we jointly took that decision of being like, you explain all the dishes, you do all the hosting, I'm cooking, and then we'll tie things up together. So I think that was a really amazing decision, because now, honestly, people like expect him to be there. So some of the events, if he is actually on call or working, I have people who are like, oh my God, like, where's Rigel? Because he's part of the experience and he's so good at that. He did a lot of drama at university and I feel like he's a very natural host. So I think he fits very well into that. He is currently calling himself the CEO of Smoke and Lime. So,
oh.
Yeah.
Self-appointed.
Yeah, I'm like, who am I? I'm like, he's like, you're the founder. I'm like, okay, that's fine.
I'll take that.
Yeah,
that sounds
so
good.
Yeah, no, but I think he's so integral to it. I run everything by him.
Yeah.
Everything that I do, every like email conversation, whatever, like he's the first person I'll sound because we've known each other since we were so young, and also he's known me before I cooked. Like the whole cooking journey has happened with him in my life, so it's very like integral in the business, in the grand scheme of things. Yeah.
Zaini, I've loved this conversation.
Yay.
I think we can talk for another.
Yeah, we probably could. We should
hours.
Have part two.
We should do. Maybe we can do it with a supper club and have like food around.
With Yesha.
With Yesha. Oh yeah, no, she would be phenomenal. A little too phenomenal. But we have a closing tradition on the show.
Yes.
Where we ask you a final question, which you have had a little bit of time to prepare for. And that question is, if your 18-year-old self had a discussion with your 80-year-old self, what would the discussion be about?
I think my 18-year-old self would be trying to be like, oh my God, I want to do all of these things. I want to be a Bollywood actress. I want to be a CEO. I didn't cook when I was 18, so that would not be in the conversation. And then I think my 80-year-old self will be like, but you fed so many people and you've taken this food tradition forward. That maybe I have this fear that Bengali food will die out because a lot of people don't cook it, either they're scared of it or whatever. So I think that's what my 80-year-old self would be saying, like, at least you've managed to do this, even if it doesn't amount to anything beyond me as a brand, and then eventually I'll get old and whatever, I'll be chilling in a farm somewhere. That's what I want to do.
Very quick question, when you serve food to someone and they take that first bite of your food and they go, this is phenomenal, how do you feel?
I can't put that into words. I think a lot of the times it's very like, it's met with silence, because I know when people are really enjoying their food is like when they go silent. So there is always that. I don't know. I feel a sense of comfort. Yeah. There's this like feeling of like, yeah, like I'm giving you something that your body, your soul needed. For me, like cooking for anyone, literally, it doesn't. And I think this is a big thing, like the table, the supper club table or any events table, it's like an equalizer space. Like I've often given, you know, people seats at the table that have told me in private that they possibly couldn't afford it and things like that. So I want it to be an equal space. I'm not doing this from the bottom of my heart. I don't think I'm doing this to like make money and get rich. I'm doing it to like pass something on. I feel the sense of comfort and like this thing of like I've achieved something by feeding someone, which is really nice. And I think I say this a lot of like, I want people to come to my events and eat and go home and have a really good sleep. That's kind of what I'm looking for. Go home, have a lovely rest, because I think we're so busy, including myself, of just like proving things and doing things and ticking off the next thing. But ultimately, if you're like nourished and happy and comfortable. That's kind of what I want. So when they take that bite, I don't know, often I'm just like, oh, I like it. It's nice. They're eating my food. So it's more like for me, even before they've said anything. And for me, it's a way of like showing love. And I would never do this otherwise. I think, yeah, this can go somewhere else. I've had someone say to me recently, they came to like shoot one of my events. And she said she was working with a load of other people who are like hosts, supper club events, whatever. And she said a lot of the, I was the first person who actually offered her food. And I was like, sorry? Like, why are people doing this if that's not what they're doing it for? Like, for me, if you can't, like, genuinely speaking, obviously I want to make a living and, you know, pay my rent in London. But if someone's like, oh, I'm, you know, want to come to your events and I can't afford to come, like, you just come and eat some food. Like, it's fine. That's what I eventually want to be doing anyway. As long as I can have a comfortable flat somewhere, that's fine. But yeah, it's very interesting to me. I think there's a lot of animosity in the business of like just profits and just finance. And for me, I don't think the food's about that, at least. Like maybe the brand stuff is, but not the food stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's your differentiator, where people will over time recognize that your food is made with that level of quality, passion. Yeah.
And that care. Comes across. And just like, I'm never feeding anyone something that I don't want to eat myself. It's for me first, and then it's for everyone. And it's coming from that place. But yeah, sorry, that didn't even answer your question. I think your question was, what do I feel? I feel lots of things. I'm just like, yay.
Deep sense of fulfillment.
It's really nice.
It's even on my rudimentary level, if I've made something and Yish is eating it, I'm always like, did you like it? What do you feel? And she'd eat it and go, this is really nice. And I go, are you sure? Is it?
I don't ask, are you really sure nice? Anymore. I think I know it's good. Yeah, I used to. I think now I'm like, I think I have the confidence now to be like, I know what I've made is good. And actually, most of the time, I don't even taste my own food. I smell it and I know it's good. I'm very like, if I have a blocked nose, I can't cook. That's a bad day.
Amazing. So yeah. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, maybe a supper club podcast.
Oh.
That'd be fun.
How exciting.
We mic everyone up. All of you just guys come
ASMR of just eating.
No, not the ASMR. Just actually, I've always thought of that. It'd be so interesting to capture the conversations around a table.
Oh,
yeah,
that would be. I'm sure you hear some weird and wonderful conversations.
It's so nice, and I, you know, one of the most beautiful parts of what I do is all these different groups of people who would never interact. They come and interact, and like, there's all these stories, and there's. It's just so fun. It's like I get a free story session like every week because I get to hear so many things that you'd end up in a bubble with your own friendship group, right? And I think we don't have that at home because like I get 20 people coming through my door like every week, and I get to interact with all of these amazing people from like different parts of the world and like different backgrounds, and it's really nice. It's very like humbling. Yeah.
And that's a beautiful way to end the show.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Shahini.